The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. It's nice to see everyone, and thank you all for coming. Welcome to the Free Library and to the Carol Phillips Memorial Lecture. I'm Andy Greenberg. I'm a member of the Free Library Foundation Board of Directors and a proud supporter of this great library. My mother, Carol Phillips, for whom this lecture is named, was an avid reader and a strong supporter of the library, and in her memory, our family endowed this lecture. If you haven't explored the Free Library in a while, I encourage you to take the time to discover all it has to offer in addition to the wonderful author event series. For those of you in the audience who have a smartphone in your pocket or purse, and I imagine many of you do, the Free Library has a great new mobile web app where you can access your library account, search the catalog, listen to author events podcasts, read book reviews, and more. Check it out at freelibrary.org/mobile. Before we begin, please take a minute to silence your cell phones. Also, I'd like to remind you that, actually, my cell phone is ringing. Let me heed my own advice. I'd also like to remind you that following tonight's event, there will be a book signing upstairs in the lobby. Books are for sale from Joseph Fox Bookshop, and a portion of the proceeds will benefit the Free Library. It's now a pleasure indeed to introduce to you the individual who will introduce our guest speaker this evening. The Reverend Dr. W. Wilson Good Sr. is the former mayor of Philadelphia and the director of the renowned Amachi Mentoring Program. Wilson is a longtime supporter of the Free Library. He's a member of both the Board of Trustees and the Foundation Board of Directors, and I'm pleased to serve with him and pleased to introduce him this evening to introduce our guest speaker. Reverend Good.
Good evening. Thank you, Andy, and good evening and welcome to all of you. I'm pleased to be here, and pleased is not strong enough word. I'm delighted to be here to introduce the legendary, iconic William T. Coleman. Born in Philadelphia, Bill Coleman went from Germantown High to the University of Pennsylvania, where he graduated and then to Harvard Law School. He was the first African-American to serve as a clerk, the Supreme Court, and to join a major U.S. law firm, becoming senior partner at Dilworth, Paxson, Kalish, Levy, and Coleman right here in Philadelphia. In a career spanning nearly 70 years, Coleman was one of the lead strategists and co-author of the legal brief working with Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP on Brown versus Board of Education. He was senior counsel to the Warren Commission, investigation of the Kennedy assassination, and he served as Secretary of Transportation during the Ford administration. And in 1995, he received the Presidential Medal of Freedom from President Bill Clinton. Counsel for the Situation is his new autobiography. According to former U.S. Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, Coleman belongs to the diminishing breed of distinguished citizen statesmen who never sought the limelight, but whose brilliant intellect brought him to the pinnacle of success in the legal field, whose passion for justice drove his commitment to civil rights, and whose sense of obligation to serve his country led him to the highest echelons of government. Coleman will be joined on stage by his daughter, LaVita H. Coleman, Jr., and director of Risk Metrics Group and a partner in the Washington law firm of Sutherland, Ashbill, and Brenner. You'll be interviewed by Paul Hendrickson, a former staff writer for the Washington Post and the author of Son of Mississippi, winner of the National Black Book Critics Circle Award. Hendrickson is professor at the University of Pennsylvania. We're honored to have them here with us tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Paul Hendrickson, Lavita H. Coleman, Jr., and William T. Coleman. Come on, give it up, please.
See if this sounds right, probably about there. Thank you all for coming. My name is Paul Hendrickson, and my job tonight is just to facilitate, just to get our distinguished guest to start telling his wonderful stories. I teach writing at the University of Pennsylvania, and I'm an old staff writer at the Washington Post, and I can remember when Mr. Coleman came to Washington. He was there ahead of me, but I can remember when I came to Washington and his name was making the papers in various ways, and he was made Secretary of Transportation under President Ford, which was not only one of his many, many accomplishments. Before we get started, I am actually going to take 30 seconds just to say, because I was invited here to do this tonight, how impressed I always am by these programs at the Free Library. I don't get to a tenth of them, but the ones that I have attended are really, really first rate. So it has to really speak well to the literacy of this city, and in particular to the people who put these programs on, Andy Cahan. And this is a wonderful setting in this magnificent building. This building isn't it exactly what a library should look and feel like? Cheers all around on that. Mayor Wilson Good, in his fine introduction, highlighted the major accomplishments of Mr. Coleman. So I guess what we can do is start talking about some things in the book that probably Mr. Coleman will then take off, will go where he wants, and his daughter Lovita here will also assist when the situation arises. I'm very drawn to photographs, and that photograph on the cover is such a wonderful photograph, and in conjunction with the very first sentence in the book. It is not Mr. Coleman's sentence. It is from the foreword by Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer. When Bill Coleman tried out for the swim team at his Philadelphia high school, the school eliminated the team rather than risk racial integration. That's the first sentence. That is the world in which Bill grew up, and that is the world that Bill Coleman helped to change. He was at Germantown High School, and they eliminated the swim team rather than to have an African American be on the team. What a terrible, terrible thought. And here he is, maybe I was trying to calculate it, maybe 25 years later, sitting on a sofa. And here's the President of the United States, Lyndon Johnson, leaning forward as if to say, Bill, what do you have to say, rather than in reverse. Bill, Mr. Coleman is seated with his leg crossed on the sofa, and Lyndon Johnson is leaning in, and all these other important people in the room, Nicholas Katzenbach. I don't know what room in the White House that was. Do you think that was the...
Was the President's office.
That was the President's office.
I think.
Do you remember that moment?
Well, I remember it in the sense I know it happened. I can't describe everything we said, but I... Really, because he had pointed of me and another person that sits there to be co-chairman of a civil rights commission where he's having an investigation. So that's what we discussed, although we discussed a lot of things other than just that. If you get the opportunity to see the president, you try to make as many points as you can in a half hour.
What so fascinates me, Mr. Coleman, is how you not only helped change history and did so many important things, but you were cheek by jowl. You were elbow to elbow with these incredibly important men. And you deep inside the book, in a chapter called Reflecting on Republicans and Race, and we might circle back to that, he talks about the various presidents through the 20th century. And he speaks of Lyndon Johnson, not a Republican, obviously. I have only praise for the courage and leadership of President Johnson. Here was a guy from West Texas whose inclinations on race might have gone another way. But it's amazing, isn't it, that he did so much for African Americans?
He did. I thought that he did, and so did President Eisenhower. He's amazing, all that President Eisenhower did over the year. His last book he wrote about 2 years before he died, you really ought to take a look at it, because he came on. I got to know him because when I was in the Air Corps, they wouldn't let the black officers in the officers club, even though they'd been fighting in Europe, coming back training to go to Japan. Got to know President Eisenhower because he was the one that certainly caused so many changes. And it's really something you don't quite understand, because he told me once when I was walking with him up in Gettysburg after he left office, I was born in Texas. I lived in the Midwest with no blacks. I then got sent to the U.S. West Point, no blacks. And then I decided to be an infantry officer stationed in the South, no blacks. He said, well, three things changed my mind. One was that during the war in Europe, the 332nd Fighter Group was tremendous airman pilots, and they trained men, and they never lost a U.S. bomber as they were protecting them, despite the fact all the bombers are white, but they back. Secondly, he said that very few people realize this, but at the Battle of the Bulge, where all the attention is given to Major General Patton, who led the troops, but it was the fact that for 4 days before Patton got there, that the black soldiers stepped up and defended that line and held it until Patton could get there. And then he said, when I came back to the United States and saw what it should be, and he really did much more than most people realize that most presidents do to try to bring about change.
I said we might circle around to that chapter as long as we're talking about President Eisenhower. That chapter, Reflecting on Republicans and Race, it's very true, I think, that the conventional wisdom, or what is kind of set in our collective consciousness, is that the Democratic Party is the great party of helping minorities and speaking out for the underprivileged. And Mr. Coleman makes such an eloquent argument. He says the roots of the Democratic Party lie with Thomas Jefferson, who held slaves. There's this great disparity between the lofty rhetoric of the Declaration of Independence and a man who held slaves. And then Mr. Coleman kind of goes through the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln, and he's talking about these various Republicans, just as you said, Dwight Eisenhower, and other. So it is your contention that the Republican Party, and you've been, a Republican for 65 years, is that what you said?
Yes. Well, my mother and father were Republicans, and I've never changed.
I guess I'll just ask this bluntly. Has anybody ever given you static through the years? Bill, why aren't you a Democrat rather than a Republican?
Well, the fact is that more Democrats have helped me than Republicans. I mean, Lou Pollack, who's sitting in the audience, a good Democrat, but yet he had as much to do with writing the brief in the Brown case as I did. Mr. Greenfield, who was in Philadelphia, did a lot to make the change. And the point that I'm trying to make and get everybody to realize, this is a great country. Certainly when we started and you had slavery and you certainly had discrimination against people of color, the country has changed and is changing, and you've always had some very important people that stepped up and helped to make the difference. In the book, for example, I handle the Bob Jones case, an institution in the South, private, but they wouldn't select blacks, or when they began to select blacks, they had great restrictions. And the Supreme Court asked me to step in and argue that, and I was able to demonstrate that you can't get the charitable deduction if you have that much racial discrimination. The day I walked to court, the person that established Bob Jones didn't speak to me. Later on, another of that family didn't. But yet, less about a month ago, I got a letter from the fourth person who said how right I were and how happy that family is that that change been made. And that's just what happens in this country. It's so many things. You know, I was at a meeting yesterday and saw the lady who's the CEO of PepsiCo. She happens to be browner than I am. She's born in India, but she's browner than I am. And it's just happening time again. Or now you take Merck, the CEO of Merck is a person of color. He's a Philadelphia young man. He first practiced a drink or better reef here and went on and has an outstanding career now.
I'm just struck by how much change has occurred in Mr. Coleman's lifetime and how much he has witnessed and how much he has also affected. Maybe we'll have a minute here. We're going to open this to the audience pretty soon. But Mr. Coleman was at Thurgood Marshall's side when they left the Wardman Park Hotel in a taxi cab in December 1953 to go to the Supreme Court. He sat beside him at the table in this historic moment in American history, Brown versus the Board of Education, which really changed everything for people of color. And he was right there at the table. And I guess I'm tempted to ask you just to give us a little human feeling of what Marshall himself was like. He's such an iconic figure. You were right at his side. It was the point I was making about Lyndon Johnson. But talk for a minute, if you will, about Thurgood Marshall.
Well, he was a tremendous person. He understood the cases. He also had the benefit of being taught by Bill Hastie, that most of you know, who was a judge here, and also by Charlie Houston. And Charlie Houston was the first person of color ever to make the Harvard Law Review, and Bill Hastie was the second. And Marshall got a lot of training from them. But in those rooms, you know, there were people, a lot of different people. You know, Lew Pollack was there all the time. I bumped into Jerry Shestack often, and he made contributions. And they were real efforts. And what I hope the book does, because I, for example, in the Supreme Court, I argued 19 cases, won all but two of them. But less than five of those cases had anything to do with race. The other were banking cases. The other set was whether you could, Southern Louisiana could charge Philadelphia $3 per MCF for natural gas. Well, we were able to convince the court that it shouldn't be more than 1.25 cents per MCF, though now, if you know, it's $8. So, but I'm just saying that if the book makes any sense at all, it really is the story of a young person that had a great mother and father, was in Philadelphia, and got in touch with a lot of different people, and they recognized that I perhaps had the same ability as anybody else and worked on that. And so I was involved in as many cases having nothing to do with race as those having to do with race. And I think that's what's happening in this country today, and we have to recognize that.
What was Thurgood's role?
Well, he was very active. At the time, he was the leader of the Legal Defense Fund, and he worked very hard. And I guess that those are in the room say oftentimes the idea he walked in with was not the same idea he had by the time we ended the meeting, because it was really give and take. I just beg any of you to read the Dred Scott case, and you realize the total terrible battle we had to overcome. And there was a lot of variations. There were five separate cases, and all the lawyers are very talented lawyers, but through being in that room and talking back and forth, we apparently said the right things, and the court went our way.
Mr. Marshall always called you by your last name. He called you Coleman, right?
Yeah. Well, he was born in the house in Baltimore right next to where my mother lived, so there was some relationship.
Mr. Coleman said a minute ago, this young man who just wanted to get somewhere in the world and do good. We were talking backstage, and I said, have you done many of these book events? He said, oh, a few. But he said, I have to get back to work. I said, really? He said, yes, I got to be at work tomorrow morning at 8:30. So Mr. Coleman is still doing it all the way. And you became Secretary of Transportation in President Ford's administration, and I was amused in the book that you resisted him. He at first wanted you to be head of HUD, Housing Urban Development. You said, no, I can't quite do that. I have obligations to three university children. And then he walks across the room and he says, well, Bill, would Ambassador to the United Nations work? And Mr. Coleman said, no, I don't think so. But on the third try, you couldn't quite, when he said, how about Secretary of Transportation? It's hard to turn down a president three times. Is that the point?
Not only that, but I didn't know what the Department of Transportation was. I never realized they had one. But I turned down the HUD position because it so happened that the first person of color ever appointed to being secretary was appointed to HUD. And I always felt, well, maybe they're making that the position for a black person. So I said no to that. I said no to the UN position, though I had about 2 years before that worked over at the UN and trying to straighten out certain problems such as South Africa's control in Namibia. And I just felt when he said the Department of Transportation that that was an opportunity that I should take. Fortunately, I didn't say yes then. I said, let me think about it. And I came home and my daughter, who was first or second year at Yale at that time, said, gee, you really ought to take that job. I don't know whether you'd do well at it, but you haven't done anything yet, so why don't you take it? And secondly, I did it because she told me that President Ford had written a piece on ethics and conduct in government, which was an outstanding piece. And thirdly, Ford was a very decent, very nice man, and I enjoyed it very much.
Yes, yeah. There are a lot of little human touches in this book. And for me, who lived in Washington for so long, I was just amused, charmed, enchanted. He talks about when he first comes to Washington to be a clerk for Supreme Court Justice Frankfurter. And most mornings, Justice Frankfurter would walk to his office from Georgetown with the Secretary of State, Dean Acheson. The two men would just stroll down the sidewalk to the old executive office building where I guess the Supreme Court and the State Department were housed. If so much change has occurred, so much change has occurred in that way too. And again, Mr. Coleman has lived through this. I wanted to read from a letter that Mr. Coleman sent. Now, this is the man who has graduated first in his class at Harvard Law. Didn't make editor of the Law Review, editor-in-chief, but an editor of the Law Review. So first in his class at Harvard Law, you would think that this is a pretty worthy candidate. He describes himself as boldly writing to Justice Hugo Black, asking about a possible clerkship. The letter itself doesn't sound bold to me, and again suggests to me this is how far we've come. He wrote, "Despite my training, owing to the fact that I am a Negro, I have encountered considerable difficulty in getting a suitable position. Your efforts and expressions in your judicial utterances led me to inquire whether you would consider me for the position as your legal clerk." There seems such an underlying humility in that letter from the man who was first in his class at Harvard Law. And I guess the question behind that, sir, is that this was the world that you were living in, and you were determined to change it, and you were not going to storm the barricades, but try to work within the system and make your way.
Well, not only that, but Mr. Justice Black was a very able judge, and though he was from the South, he, in some of the cases, seemed to lean towards a different position, and I just thought he'd be a good person to work for and with. I didn't get the opportunity, but oft times, since his office was right next door to Mr. Justice Frankfurter, he would stop me and take me to try to argue a point with me, and I would disagree with him and come on down to the office, and Justice Black would say, "Gee, that Coleman's a very difficult guy to get along with." So that's a fact of life.
I'll ask another question or two, and then we'll open this to the audience. This is a thornier question. Your admiration for President Lyndon Johnson of the other party is manifest. And you talk about how everything in his background and training wouldn't have necessarily led to the conclusion that he would do as much for people as color as he did. You say you have one severe criticism, however, of the Johnson administration, that what you feel it did was, in essence, create too much of a welfare state in America. Supportive voters created a huge government-dependent constituency. Too often the beneficiaries of some of the Great Society's programs have claimed racial entitlements, which in my judgment are neither warranted nor helpful in eliminating the vestiges of discrimination. So that's a real criticism you have.
Well, I thought that in the last 2 hours I perhaps should rewrite that, because the president, our present president of the United States, said just about the same thing.
Yeah.
And I really think that we got to get back and realize that what made this country great at the beginning was that the founding fathers felt that the things that the federal government should be are things like the army and the military and that. But when it came to making things and doing things like building automobiles, that should be done by the private sector. Mm-hmm. And the government's sole responsibility should be to regulate that, to see whether it's done fairly and see whether you don't have safety problem. But the great tradition now is the government does a lot, which I don't think they should do. For example, when I became Secretary of Transportation, the Penn Central was in bankruptcy, and it had two governmental corporations, one to operate the railroad part, the other to do the passenger part. And I wanted to take it all, put it together, sell half of it to the Chesley, and sell the other half to the Norfolk Southern. I lost that battle. I couldn't convince the Congress. But then 2 times later, when Bob Dole's wife became the Secretary of Transportation, she accomplished that. And I just think if you just look at some of the things the government's doing today, do you really think the government should be doing it, or should be done by private sector, clearly with the government having the right to regulate it to the extent that the private sector does it their own way?
A personal thank you, sir. As someone who rode the Washington, D.C. Metro for 20-odd years, you had something to do with making that metro up and running in such a clean, beautiful, the best subway system in America, I think. So thank you for that, by the way. I've waited this whole time to be able to say that.
I'd like to add the fact that that wonderful airport you have in Philadelphia had something to do with that, yeah. Too.
My father was an airline captain for Eastern Airlines and used to make the river approach to National Airport from the in DC-3s from the 1940s onward. I wonder if, as a last question, and then we'll open to the audience, until I read this book, I now do have a clear grasp on it, on what a counsel for the situation is. What is a? I had not heard that term, and I now have a pretty clear idea what a counsel for the situation, as opposed to a counsel for the client. Would you talk about that? Would you explain that?
Well, obviously, you need the client, and until he or she comes into the room, you certainly will act as though the client's the most important thing in the world. But once they come in the room, you realize you have a problem. And you got to solve that problem, and you have to sometime do it in a way which is supportive of what the client thought should be done. Other times, you don't. I remember greatly in 1980, I was asked by Don Kendall, who at that time was head of PepsiCo, to go with him to the Soviet Union to have a discussion, because 1980 is the year of the Olympics. And Coke had come in and pretty much got the rules that Pepsi could be kicked out. So I went into this meeting with Don Kendall, myself, and Brezhnev and his top assistant. What did I talk about the first 2.5 hours? I talked about Alexander Pushkin. Now, I'm willing to bet you that if I asked here how many people in this audience realized that Pushkin was black. Well, okay. Well, most of you didn't. But not only that, but the grandfather, who was a great-grandfather, the first one came over, he married a Russian noblewoman, and Peter the Great liked him so well that he made him also a Russian nobleman. He then made him a major general and sent him to Europe for 5 years to learn how to use artillery fire. And he comes back in the Battle of Petrograd in 1707, the Russians defeated, the first time ever a European power, they defeated Charles the 12th of Sweden. And because of that, after about 2.5 hours, Brezhnev said, well, I have to go out for 5 minutes to some reason. But as he left the other person in the room, he apparently told him, you know, Mr. Coleman's been here 2.5 hours. He still hasn't told us what we want. But tell him that he certainly knows so much about the Soviet Union that whether he wants, I'll try to give it to him.
Counsel for the situation. Let's have some questions from the audience. I think the way we would like to do this now, this is important, is please raise your hand and the runners in the aisles will make sure that you get a microphone. So someone start us out there with something you would like to ask Mr. Coleman. Yes, sir or ma'am. I can't quite tell. It's my fading eyes.
Thank you and good evening. It's an honor to be here tonight. And I just wanted to ask you, sir, what do you think about the public schools in America that are still not desegregated?
I have trouble hearing you.
The question is... what do you think about the public schools in America that sadly are still not integrated, that may, in fact, could be called segregated in many ways still?
I think it's something that has to be changed, and it has to be changed not only in the interest of the people of color who suffer, but also the rest of the community. I must say that when I came to Philadelphia, and went to, what was that place we went yesterday morning?
The community college.
Community College. I was very impressed. So they built a great institution there. They said they had about 42,000 pupils going to school there now. And it just seemed as though you had people of all races, all colors, all sexes, really interested in trying to learn various different issues. And I thought that that's going to really help the country. And I think that's what you really need. You know, I look at this audience and I know that there's certain people bright as hell because sometimes they beat me. So, but the fact is that brain power is out there. And you just have to be able to spot it and know how to use it. Or people that are not quite that bright, but they have other issues. You know, after all, you look at the military in time of war, there are only less than 3% of those people that are Phi Beta Kappas. But the rest of them can fight well and do well and make good judgment. That's something that this country has to recognize and make use of.
Another question, please. Yes, sir.
Mr. Coleman, with recent elections, we now have two of the first black congressmen out of the Confederate South since Reconstruction, Tim Scott of South Carolina, Alan West of Florida. We have notable progress for African Americans in the Republican Party around the country, and even in Philadelphia we have some distinguished individuals of that persuasion. I wonder, though, if you could briefly reflect on the viability of the Republican Party in Philadelphia, perhaps, and how, particularly in a city that's 46% African American, where 4 out of 5 voters vote Democrat, and where you have no Republican mayor in nearly 60 years, part of the opportunity may be within the Republican Party in Philadelphia to reach out to the African American community and forge new ties. I would say this quick coda, of course, Mayor Good in 82 really triumphed in a racially polarized race, but it over Rizzo, but it suggests that perhaps there may be more progress to be made on that front. Thanks, sir.
Well, I think that, you know, you just have to reach out for it. You get to be selected if you get involved with the right group of people. But my thinking is that at my age, I would look at a baseball game and watch the Phillies or the Athletics play, and they were all white. I then would go to watch the people in the black leagues play, and Satchel Paige and another one, as good as any white boy there.
Or better.
And now, you know, you look at it, and you know, you see both there. You see people of color who are managers of baseball teams. But that could happen anything. You know, this young man the other day who just been made CEO of Merck. Merck's certainly an outstanding. Ken Frazier is certainly an outstanding company, and he's just been made the COO of Merck, which is a tremendous job. And he started at Drinkwell and Reef here and went on and became general counsel. And I just think the opportunity is there, but you've got to seize it, and you've got to make the contacts and get to know people that otherwise you wouldn't know if you just stuck to your own neighborhood.
Yes, ma'am. Here comes a microphone.
That's okay. I think I can be heard.
This is Jim
Bill.
Our judge.
Bill, this is a very personal question. Another brilliant African-American from Philadelphia who did beautifully in school became a committed communist, and that's Paul Robeson. And I wonder if you would comment on what there is in your background that led you in an entirely different way, as I know from our background, you real a believer in the capitalist system. What is it that caused the difference, or at least in your case, that led you to believe in this form of economy?
Well, Judge, if I could answer that question, I'd come down before you tomorrow and try to get you to file the right motion. But the real answer is I don't know, other than the fact that if you go to grammar school or high school, you work awfully hard and you try to be as good as anybody else in the class. You try to get a job during the summer where you're doing something other than scrubbing somebody's floor, and it just happens. But I'm saying that so much has happened today, not enough, that it's going to be hard for the next generation to say that the color of my skin is the reason why I don't have a job. That's my feeling. I'm pretty sure most people in this room will disagree with me, but that's where I feel. Just look at it. You know, it ain't every day that the President of the United States is a person of color, but that certainly ought to give you a message that this society has changed and is willing to change if the right people throw their hat in the ring.
And that question, if I could just append to it, seems to me I'll be thinking about it all the way home, because if I hear your question correctly, Robeson excelled and was a motivated, committed young man, but went this way with his anger, became a communist and a disbeliever in the American system. And Mr. Coleman went in a route that took him every bit as high and higher, you could argue, in a totally different sphere than Paul Robeson, and yet stayed kind of within the channels of, this is how I will achieve, and this is how I will knock down this barrier. Another question. Yes, yes, ma'am. Here comes a microphone.
Perhaps Dad working with Judge Slaughter led him in the right direction.
He was the partner, right? The associate.
Yes.
Good evening.
That didn't last very long, though.
Good evening to you.
I can't quite hear you.
If you put the microphone a little closer to your mouth.
I didn't want it to echo. I'm sorry. Good evening, everyone. I wanted to ask you a question a little bit about how you view the current conservatives versus yesterday's conservatives and yesterday's ideals of the Republican Party, because obviously it shifted tremendously in the last, I would say, 10 years. A lot of the representation from the Republican Party is obviously not a major representation of what yesterday's Republicans believed, and they've often been referred to in a very negative manner.
Yes.
I am personally a Democrat, but I wanted to get your thoughts on that, because there it has been a major shift in ideology with the current today's Republicans.
Well, one, I never thought that any political party really does that much to really make the change. It has to be there, and they have to realize it's their benefit to do it. I think it's more the fact that this library, for example, is not only here, but they have institutions all over this city. And you never know when that kid, you know, reads the book, comes in, and listens, and he picks up stuff that otherwise he wouldn't pick up. I also think there's a fundamental responsibility of all our schools to see that its student body has a cross-section of people. I get concerned sometimes to realize that a lot of high schools or schools are basically all white or all black because of where the neighborhood in which people lived. But yet, you know, here that the bright kids all went to Central and the girls went to Girls High now. And, you know, the fact that you travel from Germantown to go down to Central, to me, is just irrelevant. And after all, you got extra time to read on the subway so you can pick up. But I really want people to think of that. That if you see the opportunity, or the opportunity for your children, and if you somehow can mix together and get to know a lot of different people, the chances that your kids are going to break through and do better are much better than if you permit these separate institutions to continue to exist.
If I could follow up just a little on that question, I think the questioner was also asking how, in the last 10 years, that the image of the Republican, some images of the Republican Party have become what? Reactionary, arch-conservative, and that different from the Republican Party maybe that you grew up in, and how do you view this?
Well, I think the extent it does is wrong, and they ain't going to win many elections. I mean, you know, the people have all different views, and you'd be amazed that after the election's over, if you said, why did you vote for X or Y? And you'll say, oh, gee, I never thought that was a reason to vote, but that's what happened. And it's just, you know, it's hard to explain, but we're all human beings. We all have different talents. And if we get the opportunity to show that to different people, you then get help to have the spots that you have to have in the political process. On the other hand, you know, when Hugh Scott was senator from Pennsylvania, he was a very nice guy, and he'd always take care of me, so I didn't think I had to get into politics. So, well, that's just a fact of life.
How about another question? Yes, sir. Here comes a microphone.
Okay. Bill, in your extraordinary career, the array of contributions you've made both in as an advisor to, what, half a dozen presidents, and in your law practice,
about a
variety of government appointments that you've had, there's one aspect which I've always thought was an enormously important contribution to how to govern the United States that I think gets very little publicity. I'm thinking of the process, Bill, by which, when you were Secretary of Transportation, you determined whether Concorde should or should not be permitted to land in the U.S. And my recollection is that you held essentially public hearings, arguments before the Secretary of Transportation. I don't think anybody had ever heard of a cabinet member having a public discussion of major public policy issues. I think it's enormous and ought to be replicated. But I'd love to hear what your thoughts are about that.
Well, if you've read all the letters that I read from those American Airlines that didn't have the Concorde, you could understand that it was nice to have the public issue for that reason. But that's how you get a lot of things done. And I found that in all of these basic public issues, there you ought to be able to go in and hear talk to the president, talk to the cabinet officer. I think, for example, you know, we have a lot of problems with respect to Israel and the countries around it. And I just think that if you could really go and talk to the Secretary of State and really have it back and forth so you can hear all argument, it may resolve the problem. Maybe I'm naive, but I think that one essence of the American democratic system was that citizens were supposed to have much more contact with the people running the country than usually is the case, even with respect to Great Britain and other places. And it's just a matter of getting back and forth. Well, you being a good judge, if you'd ever say that when you set down a case before you heard the argument, you probably was going to vote for the other guy. But once you heard the argument, that at least caused you to think about it, the two sides. And that's just the fact of life.
We're going to have one or two more questions. Yes, sir.
Bill, I just wondered if you could tell us with this long, remarkable career, apart from your remarkable family, what do you consider to be your single most amazing achievement, your best achievement?
Well, I wouldn't be able to figure that out. I shouldn't think this way. I know my daughter's going to kick me. But the first thing I say, oh, gee, which one did I make the most money out of? And I know you're not supposed to say that. But then you get different social things, and you watch them change. I certainly think that if you measure what was happening when the day I was born with respect to minorities and also respect to women, you know, the idea that to be a woman justice on the Supreme Court of the United States. You now got three of them. Three. And you know, it's just happening. You know, the world's changing, and you got to recognize that, and you got to realize that different people now have a great opportunity, but they have to get into the system and know how to work the system.
One last question.
Yes, ma'am.
I have a question. What do you think, what do you think of individuals as private citizens who can represent themselves pro se? How do you feel about that? Some attorneys and some people within the system approve it is constitutional, but some people, even some judges, they do not take to it too well. As long as it, you know, is beneficial for the case or cases, you know, I think it really does help. And sometimes you do need an attorney on the side. But I'm wondering what you think of something like that, since you did civil rights so much. And I have many other questions I wish I really could ask you, too.
Well, it depends. Once again, you know, if you meet somebody who's a congressman, and you talk to him about these issues or talk to her about these issues, and that's what it takes. I mean, it's amazing the number of people you've met and you see and get an opportunity to talk to them, maybe play a little tennis with them or something. And it's amazing how if they will listen and you can change their mind if you're right. Now, that doesn't mean just because you meet with a person, he's going to end up voting for you or she's going to end up voting for you. But that's happening all over now. You know, today you look at the Congress and the leadership there, you know, that lady who was or still is Speaker of the House, she's tremendous. She won't be Speaker after another 3 weeks, but she's tremendous, and she just had the ability to back. She originally was from Baltimore, Maryland. Her father, I think, was Mayor of Baltimore, and I negotiated with him on several issues. And that just, it just happened. But you know, it's a political system. You're supposed to get out there and talk to people. If you do that, you'll then find that people pay more attention to you than if you don't.
The reason I asked you this was this library is one of the places because I could not...
You're dropping your voice. I can't hear you.
I'm sorry. My voice is going down. This library is one of the places I used the federal library, and I used another one also, because I had some in school, some case, some history, some lost classes, and just some interest in the United States system, because some things happened to me. I could not obtain a private attorney, and I did research here, and I did file them in U.S. District Court, and that's why I was, you know, asking you, and there was another instance where I had to use...
You know, we're going to have to cut this off
so
because...
I was wondering, in that sense, that's why I'm asking you, from the level, it wasn't just a rhetorical question.
Yeah.
Mr. Coleman is going to sign some books, and this is a man who turned 90 last July and says he's going to go to work at 8:30 tomorrow. I also would like to thank his daughter, LaVita, who is here tonight, a distinguished attorney in her own right. And I heard her call him Pops backstage, and that made me smile. Pops. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.